good evening. I want to thank Paul and Obed for inviting me here tonight. People ask me why I write poetry. They say there's no money in it, no fame really. And they're right. I tell them I don't have a choice. That I have to deal with the ghosts that come into my head. And sometimes if I'm in a good mood, I give them two little anecdotes. First one is a few lines from Neruda's poem, Poesy, in which he wrote about how poetry came to him. I didn't know what to say. My mouth could not speak. My eyes could not see. And something ignited in my soul. Fever or unremembered wings. And I went my own way, deciphering that burning fire. And I wrote the first bare line, bare without substance, pure foolishness. No, pure wisdom of one who knows nothing. And suddenly I saw the heavens open. The second one is my own little story. It's not as exciting as his lines, but there was something mysterious about it. I was 14 and I was doing homework in the kitchen in Carrickbeg, Carrickenshire, listening to music and having a mug of tea, when suddenly I got the urge to pick up a pen and open a fresh page, and I wrote my first poem. And after that, through the years of third, fourth, and fifth, sixth year, my poems are all published in The Voice School magazine. I haven't got the actual poem that I wrote that day, but I do have one for a year later, maybe. It's called Fear. Maybe I will roam the hills free of care and sorrow. Find some house of my ancestors and live there happy with no care of tomorrow. I'll maybe fish for food when I'm hungry or sit a while in the sun, feeling its warm rays scorching my back. But knowing it's good, I'll never run. And I'll have no fear of tomorrow and years to come. The poems that are on these sheets are all fairly recent, whereas I have to go into this book for some of the others. This poem is called Willow Pattern and it's self-explanatory. Willow Pattern. When you stop the car, I make to clear away through the years of briars. You tug my sleeve and tell me nothing good ever came out of this place. But I remember pink flowers climbing a whitewashed wall and the sun shafting through tall trees on this very lane. Drama on a winter's night in an old outhouse, the slippery hind legs of a bull calf tied with rope and pulled by you and uncle out of the groaning dark. The timeless place behind the barn they called a haggard, where mangles and ploughs waited and an unhitched cart stood, its straight shafts like tilting goalposts pointing towards the stars. And you told me yourself about the willow pattern plates that grace the fine oak dresser, how on Sunday his master's voice set the walls quaking. You must remember the good times. How can you say that nothing ever came out of this place? Your head is full of gems. I'll need a good sharp billhook to clear the lane, and Wellington boots for the stream that bleeds across it. Decades of stubborn thorn and looping briar contrive to stop us. But I'm in no hurry now. We have gone much deeper somewhere else today. This next poem is inspired by the Moonwalkers of 1969. There's some of you around who probably remember that. And also some of the writings of the late John O'Donohue about belonging and home. Where is home? Night, and once again I'm driving back from Carrick, home again from home, and keeping promises, doing my duty, as a bird swooping, diving, and swerving, dipping through streams of blinding headlights on the night drive. Down for the weekend, I show my children places where I was young once. The pattern of Motel, Clonay Strand, the Cummers, and the moon in 1969 painted in 60s black and white. A picture way out off the coast of Cape Canaveral of three small parachutes and space capsule, saying it all about coming home and seeing things for the first time. 30 years back, as tonight the car comes to a halt with a gentle lift, a soft splashdown, outside the town library at the bridge lights. And in the time it takes for the lights to change from red to green, something happens. We have stopped rushing into the future, have travelled light years back to a place where everything that happened is happening still. First tooth, first step, first word, and my parents standing in a darkened doorway. For 2 hours, the children in the back seat fight and struggle with sleep. They see the leaves in the flying trees turn slowly into night. They watch the great signposts of the night sky, Orion and Plough, dodge and dip around each country bend as if in play. Then we stop, and everyone leans forward to look through the capsule windows. And in that moment, when the colours are changing from red to green, a picture builds, unfolds in my head, like the bright neon sign on the far wall, offering its hollow paradise of sea and sun. Outside, the Saturday night mass goers splash through the quietly lapping waves. Three powerful swans beat the night air into unmistakable sound, their great wings like oars cutting through mythical seas. They are back. They are home. The marshmallow men who danced upon the moon and brought back gifts of dust and stone. My wife and I turned to the back seat, and all our care. Still there, still human, still child, struggling through the thin veils of sleep, arms and legs crisscrossing like heavy branches, and voices rising through a forest of limbs, the same voices that sounded in every town and village, from Carrick to Castlecomer. "Where are we now?" my children ask. And I answer, we are home. We are nearly home. Okay. This next one is a more recent poem. It's called The Maps, and it's kind of my little rant against the society I live in, this capitalist, consumerist society. And also, I suppose, it's a rant against the politicians in Ireland who from the very start back in the 40s have neglected rural Ireland and in fact have been part of the disintegration of rural Ireland. This poem is called The Maps. I used to have a small holding in my head and mixed the meal for bantam hens and fed leftover spuds to hairy pigs, though I only ever lived it in the meadows of my mind. Down in the lee field, I touched the spiky straw. My palms reddened from the cut stalks. Heaven was the sun going down and my spirits lifting. Now everything has gotten so confused. Gone are the times when a Buddhist monk could find enlightenment in the local post office, or sit a while in the dusty waiting room of the local railway station, where everything that happens, happens again and again. But today, society wants everything now. It will not wait to know the real pleasure of longing. The perfect pleasure of one. And so we are lost. Lost to ourselves and everyone. We visit shopping malls and turn on social network sites in the hope that we may find an answer, or at least some wise stranger who still has the maps, still knows the pathway back to where we left our souls. This next poem took me a long time to write, and it merged with another poem, and finally it just hit me, this is it, you know. It was published in Orbis by a girl over there in England. How we stand in this space. Poems, there's a little quote here, poems show us that everything is part of everything else. This is not what it seems. They looked for a long while from the shallows, unable to move. Many years, in fact, they gazed at the bathers swimming and playing out of their depth. They would soak up each splash of 1,000 teardrops when a body dived or jumped from the high pier into the satin surface as though a camera held that moment. It was almost perfect. This watching the beauty of their forms, these sensual bodies, thin and tall. At other times, they looked lifeless, like when a swallow detoured into our attic space and drowned alone in the water tank. A mess of feathers and wet decaying flesh, motionless, without flight, all arcs and hoops and curves and great compass-like invisible trails of flight, now only turning in my head. But would it not have been different had we come out of the shallows, swimming across the harbour, assuming our place in the scheme of things? Then again, that isn't it at all. It's all in the gesture. How we stand in this space. Our lives coming and going like the ebb and flow of sand, sea and time. The effect we have on the onlookers, if we believe what we say matters, if we believe it is true. this next poem is a poem that I got inspired to write many years ago, but because of the nature of the poem itself, I put it back in the drawer and I took it out again a couple of years ago. You may remember this, it was in all the newspapers the day after it happened. It was a photograph taken by Eddie Adams, the photographer, an American, of Viet Cong Captain Bailoff as he is shot in the head by SV, South Vietnamese General Long, Saigon, 1968. It's all over the internet if you go in there, and it is a horrible photograph. But there was something about it that made me write this poem. I'm not sure what. Anyway, photographing a nightmare. There's nothing decent or redemptive in this hackneyed photograph. Not the Marine's look of horror at the action of his superior. Not the silent rage of the avenging bullet fired from a small pistol in the general's hand. This is how it ends for the Viet Cong captain. His hands tied behind his back. The sound of a pistol and he slumps to the ground. Two fountains gushing from his head. The camera holds his last grimace, alive with the face of sudden death. The bullet's trajectory meets the path of the camera lens and both pierce his head. It is disturbing, seeing in his face the moment of impact, the instant of death. For General Lone, it is personal and his duty. Everything else around that moment he has dealt with. But one detail haunts, and it is not the look in Bailoff's eyes as they were closed forever, nor the obscene poverty Lone's action caused to Bailoff's family. Each night, asleep, he's back again in Saigon, at the same street corner, where he awakens in a pool of darkness, his index finger, a Smith & Wesson, aimed at his head. The next one is a personal poem. It's about my father. My father married my mother in the middle of the war during the emergency, and they bought a house after a while in Carrickenshire. But he was a very resourceful man, and he joined all of these church political groups and the drama society, and he also did carpentry, and actually some of the work that he did is with my siblings now, because I was too slow to get them. But I did go looking in the house. This poem is called My Father in the Wooden Pane. Now, there's a reference to a sculpture by Rodin in the second last verse. When he passed away, I searched the house for traces of him, would still be there. A Franciscan scapular of cotton string he wore around his waist, a ring fort that would keep him safe. His watch, his favorite tie, his rosary, and the tiny prayer book with Jesus pointing to his heart, still in his inside pocket, though no heart beats. He loved to work with wood, and I was looking for some small piece he made, or one of his carpenter's tools, that I might find him in again. Then the stair hole offered up his wooden plane, something I had seen him work with, and remembered sitting beneath his makeshift bench as shavings fell like snowflakes. to the floor. Handmade from Irish beech, embraced by his calloused palms a thousand times. Skin and wood worn to a sheen. Out of the dust and dark the memories emerge, out of the rings of time they leave from this seasoned beach. Not just a keepsake. Its like was used in Egypt before Noah built the ark. And I'm reminded of Rodin's unfinished Le Pensée, a woman's head on a granite slab, whose eyes in stone must surely capture the hardest heart, like something held so often captured mine. This poem is called Visitors. Our house backed on to the river shore, and we had visitors coming up from the river. And the poem was published by Hossein Min in Singapore, and he sent me an email asking, when he had accepted it, asking what were the visitors. I was just dumbfounded. Anyway, visitors. Over the river wall they came, through spaces between stones raised to give the yard an end, stealing up through a jungle of might come in useful, planks and old boards, galvanized sheets and rotting doors, trees of refuge to hide behind and scurry in and out of. Quiet visitors, until the snap of teeth, flesh welded to steel ran red, and the tight walls of our closed yard tossed and threw the cries of their heart-thumping squeals to a boy who knew that life must end in his own backyard, as sure as the blunt axe falling on the blank ground. No visitors come where I live now. No river passes by. No traps spring late at night. And I don't have to hear their cries. We only meet now on the open road, and I swerve to let them by. Okay, what's next? This is a poem now. It's about a painting that I love. I love Caravaggio's work, the chiaroscuro worker, you know, darkness and light. But there's one of these paintings that has always captured me, and that is the Road to Emmaus. And I've written so many pieces about it, and none of them really work. But this one came out, I thought. The innkeeper brings more wine and stares after Caravaggio's supper at Mass. I am beyond time and space when I climb into this frame, merge with this colour. There I can see what the artist has done with street people and a very pretty boy. It looks something not quite perfect. And that is why, at this viewing, I am sitting at the next table taking notes for the poem. Jesus, still with his boyish face, holds his hands over bread and wine and speaks in whispers. Food and drink on a white tablecloth is like a 16th century still life. The cooked chicken and bread, fruit placed precariously, water in a striking glass container. The innkeeper brings more wine and stares. I could be this man too, who looks but cannot see. I have carried this for so long, the canvas, the colors, the infamous chiaroscuro all in Caravaggio's head. His troubled life emerges from the light, and darkness must place good in his heart. He can take the past, his present, and make it new, almost transcendent. How are we doing for time, all right? This poem is about two people that lived up the road from me when I was young, Agnes and Jimmy Jakes. Now, Agnes played music in the Friary Church, and Jimmy was a boatman, went from Carrick down to Waterford, brought down grain, brought sand back on the Knockmiggle, as they were called. And I knew Agnes, but I never actually saw Jimmy. Agnes plays music in the Friary. I never knew what Jimmy looked like, or if he was bald and wore a cap to hide it. I knew he was a boatman and might have had a tattoo of Agnes naked on his arm. Agnes, who played Handel at Sunday Mass and came down the hill in her slippers and wrinkled raincoat. It may have been during one of the oratorias that I sensed something was wrong. But that was weeks before the drowning. That night on deck, he could not see his hand. As he broke the surface for the last time, there was only wind and rain to hold on to. Agnes could not touch the keys for weeks to come. When she did come back, the music wasn't the same. She couldn't get him out of her head, nor the boatmen get him out of the river. And she dreamt she saw him stuck on a riverbed tree, his ghostly white face staring out at her, or down at the mouth of the river. Handel's Suite Number 1 in F major, playing in the breaking waves above him. I was 10, and I knew I would never see Jimmy. The next poem is it's called The Yard, and it kind of refers back to the one of the visitors came into that yard, but it was a place that I played in as a child, and I was delighted that John Wakeman accepted it for publication in the last, unfortunately, issue of The Shop. Anyway, The Yard. The yard was narrow, seemed long as a lane, like a road leading to a cliff. The ceiling was blue and white, and standing at the back wall at full tide was like being on the downside of a dam. Shadow and light were permanent parts of old doors and boards, changing only when a ball went missing or a mouse moved. I loved each jutting rock, each hole and crevice, down to the end wall and the river. The keys, the backs of houses on the other side, like the back of a film street set. And was this a film I played in every day? My own private piece of heaven. A shed made from galvanized and old boards, housing coal, potatoes and tools. A dark little concrete cube to pee in. I can see my mother now at the back window, at the back of this heaven, where angels thread like dancing wallflowers, and a boy, a poet, a nightingale, are in blissful shadow. The rusty old paint tins she kept her plants in, geranium, wild rose, hydrangea, and every clinging web that still amazes on frosty mornings, though I'm never there. The curtains were dry stone walls. They held up the blue and the clouds. There were flowers, images in glass, a mound of surplus sand, and those winter nights as a child, I'd sit in the cold outside toilet, listening to night sounds. A tomcat crying, the wind howling, galvanized sheets battering, terrified, but never giving in. Imagination plucking images out of the dark, and my left leg holding the door half open in order to let in light. Anyway,
two more.
Okay, Donnelly's Hollow. This was the poem that won the Cecil Day Lewis Award, and it's. Are you okay, David?
Yeah, that's fine. Yourself?
Thought you were going to sleep.
I've heard them before. So.
Anyway, I lived in. David was born in Kildare, up in Kildare. We lived there for about 30 years, and we used to go out and bring himself and his brother and my daughter out to a place called Donnelly's Hollow. I don't know if any of you ever stopped in Kilcullen years back now, because it's sold now, but the hand of Dan Donnelly, the whole arm, was in glass in the hideout, right? And apparently a few years back, the guy that owned it, he sold the pub and he brought the arm to America, and I don't know how he got on with it, whether he sold it or not. It was the arm of Dan Donnelly, and Dan Donnelly fought the Englishman George Cooper in Donnelly's Hollow. Now the land is like a ladle. It's just like that, you know? And it was perfect for a match, because over 20,000 people came to this fight in 1812 or 1815, according to the local notes and the historical stuff. Anyway, Donnelly's Hollow. The earth here holds more. Excuse me. The earth here holds more than just the droppings of sheep or the slow flowering of furs. At sunrise, the canter of horses circling on the curra is the only sound to be heard. At the edge of the hollow, by afternoon, especially at weekends, the air can be filled with child noise. Over there, the whistle of nine irons. Behind me, the whine and rattle of engines. And today's adventurers, letters, goggles, scarves, nonchalantly whipping the air. The muffled sound of practice guns reaches from beyond the trees. 6 months after Wellington sent the French reeling at Waterloo, local history has it that in 1815, a crowd almost half the size of that victorious army watched Dan Donnelly defeat the Englishman, George Cooper, on this very spot. This evening, no army or bustling crowd disturbs the peace of the hollow. A few sheep graze and stand like sentries around a granite monument. From the perimeter edge, the sun falls behind Allen and all its own mythologies. The forest spread like fire to this common ground, and in that yellow blaze, several thousand wave and cheer as Cooper, barefistedly battered, falls to the ground in under 12 unmerciful and bloody rounds. Skateboards glide across and up and down these grassy slopes now. Only the shouts of children toss and throw the piece of the hollow. Parents watch from cars, doze restfully on reclining seats, as if this place offered something more than just a stone reminder around which their children tussle, unaware of their local history, or the fact that this ladle of ground they play upon holds human blood, spilled and held here, as in the hollow of the landscape's open hand. And the last poem I'll read, okay? Now, this kind of refers back a little bit to the Where Is Home poem about the moon people, the moon makers, the moon walkers. And it's a true story, really. My parents let me go and work when I was 14 in a hotel in Dunmore East, the Ocean Hotel. And, well, you can imagine, 14 working in a hotel, it was great. Anyway, Zero Gravity, 1969. Maybe it was a ruse after all, a man walking on the moon. The press told of hangars in the desert, political decisions, the rest is history. But real or imaginary hardly counts. In a whirling daze of new things, a teenager making tracks on the lunar surface of a summer hotel, warned by parents of dangers ahead. Black holes, exploding stars, the inevitable re-entry. But the noise from the engine of the old Morris drowned out their words as they drove away. Then lost in an adult world of work and play. Summer passed quickly and soon we were all staring at the moon. On the night of the landing, we watched in awe. Most in their working gear, like the astronauts bouncing on the TV screen. But in the corridor outside, a drama just as great was unfolding. Surprised and startled by an older girl who kissed me out of the blue, my first wet kiss. Like a shooting star, it lasted only seconds. But I was out there now, 14, and weightless. For days they couldn't hold me down.